from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Dave Iverson. In the often acrimonious debate over how we handle healthcare in this country, we often focus on the role of big institutions, big government, big insurance, big healthcare providers. We spend less time thinking about the role of individual patients in shaping the care they receive. But several programs around the country now, including one here at UCSF, are doing just that, focusing on how patients can play a more active role in determining the course of their own treatment. They help patients prepare questions, provide pre-med students to accompany them on doctor visits, and arm them with informational videos. Putting patients more in charge of their own care. Our topic, next on Forum, after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Dave Iverson. When you're diagnosed with a serious health condition, it can be overwhelming. What does disease X or condition Y really mean? What does the future hold? And most important, what do I do next? At such moments, we turn to our doctors. Hopefully, they'll have the answer. And they often do have an answer. The question is it the right answer for you? How do you assess the pros and cons? Did your doctor even tell you all the pros and cons? Now, several programs around the country are working hard to get patients more engaged in the decision-making process, including the Decision Services Unit at UCSF's Breast Care Center. That project provides patients with everything from informational videos to assistance in preparing for doctor's visits. So, how does what a patient knows impact the kind of treatment that they decide to pursue? And how do doctors feel about contending with a more informed patient? Joining us this hour to talk about patient decision-making, Dr. Jeff Belcora. He's assistant professor at UCSF and directs the Decision Services Unit at the Breast Care Center. He also consults with numerous other healthcare providers in the Bay Area and around the country. Dr. Belcora, good morning.
Good morning.
Happy to have you join us. Dr. Peter Ubel joins us as well. He's professor of medicine and psychology at the University of Michigan, where he directs the Center for Behavioral and Decision Sciences in Medicine. He joins us this morning by telephone from Traverse City, Michigan. Dr. Ubel, thanks for being with us.
My pleasure to be here.
And Lynn joins us as well. She is a cancer patient at UCSF. She's not using her full name this morning out of concern over possible workplace discrimination because of that diagnosis. Lynn, good morning.
Good morning.
Thanks all very much for being here and exploring this really interesting question, particularly at a time when we're all so focused on the question of healthcare and how it's delivered in this country. But let's begin, if we might, Lynn, by your describing what happened to you at the moment of your diagnosis and how that began to affect your feelings about wanting to know more.
Well, I was totally unprepared for that diagnosis. I had no symptoms at all. I didn't have a lump. I had gone in for just a routine mammogram. And it did show some irregularity, but I had had irregular mammograms before that were all benign, nothing serious. And that type of cancer or that type of symptom ran in my family. So I was totally unprepared for anything. And the doctor that I went to, my primary care sent me to a surgeon, and she just basically dropped it on me. She just said, she looked at the mammogram and she goes, "That's cancer." I have to say I really never experienced anything like that in terms of immediately having a disconnect. It's a, I would describe it as a shock. You're hearing what the doctor says, but you don't really connect with it. She, you know, rushed me in to have a biopsy, which frightens you even more because you think it's something terribly serious and aggressive, and just said, "You should consider having surgery. I'm going on vacation. You can have it next week if you want it."
So very quickly, you went from being kind of overwhelmed or shocked by this diagnosis to, here's what you should do.
Right. Exactly.
And Dr. Belcora, what does that situation tell us in terms of how news is delivered and how doctors typically deliver it, and what it is that you're interested through your project at the Breast Care Center at UCSF in beginning to develop.
Right. Well, our project actually picks up usually after the diagnosis. And in this case, maybe we can go back to Lynn and pick up the story, because I think you came to us after that diagnosis elsewhere and came to our program for a second opinion or to perhaps have care.
What actually happened was I just instinctively said I am not doing anything that fast without more information. But I was not at UC at the time, and my insurance didn't cover really anything except for that doctor. So I got on the internet and tried to get some information, but I did get a second opinion at UC. And through that second opinion, eventually got on a clinical trial, which then made me eligible for a lot of the services at UC. And they were the ones, the doctors at UC, who gave me the tapes and gave me the other information that's provided to their program by Dr. Belcora.
So describe, Jeff Belcora, if you would, the kinds of information that you try to provide so that you're not moving so quickly from this moment of diagnosis to, okay, and now it's time for surgery.
Right. And this is going to differ in different conditions, but breast cancer is not typically an emergency. So we have time to say, and in my program, what we do is try to communicate to patients that really we want you to take the time for three strategies: to review high-quality information, to make a list of questions for your doctor, and to bring someone who can take notes and audio record the visit. Because as Lynn was saying earlier, you're under shock and it's hard to connect with the information. So we provide high-quality information materials. That's the first step, provided by the Foundation for Informed Medical Decision-Making. That's a foundation in Boston, Massachusetts. And they've developed these videos and booklets called decision aids. These decision aids feature graphics and explanations by doctors and patients telling their stories and how they're experiencing different decisions and outcomes. And they really serve to give people an introduction to the topic at hand. Now, once you've reviewed those materials, they don't answer all the questions. From our purpose, you know, they serve to stimulate more focused questions. So we want you to write those down. And the kind of advice I'm providing here for your listeners is really general, that even if you're not at UC or not in our particular program, our support program, you can take this advice to heart and make sure that you go into your meeting with a doctor having written down the specific questions after reviewing high-quality information.
At a certain level, it seems basic, you know, that you should be well informed, that you should get good information, that you should have, whether it's brochures or video, that provide that key kind of quality of information, that you should prepare for your doctor visits, take time to write out questions. But how does that vary with, I guess, the norm, Peter Ubel, as you've studied this at the University of Michigan? One of the findings that I know you're beginning to come to, at least, is that doctors don't necessarily do that, that that's not the norm, and that they tend to talk more about the benefits of particular treatments than they do the risks of those treatments. Describe what you're finding in terms of the way in which this typically goes.
I'll give you an example in a prostate cancer setting where we're audio taping encounters between urologists and men who have been newly diagnosed with prostate cancer. So kind of like Lynn's story, where you get that shock, or you're told you have the cancer, we listen to what happens for the next 10, 15, 20 minutes, and often people end up with a treatment decision in that space of time after the doctor has downloaded gigabytes of information into their overwhelmed, scared, freaked out minds, and that ends up being the decision process.
So within 15 minutes, you move from shock to, guess what, you're having surgery?
And it's almost always surgery when the first person who tells you have a cancer is a surgeon. Absolutely.
And are you also finding that in that precious 15 minutes, Peter Ubel, that there's a lot more talking on the doctor's part than listening to what the patient would actually want?
Oh, absolutely. I think that we don't recruit people. We don't pick people to go into medical school based on their emotional and social intelligence. You know, it's based on their scientific intelligence. And so you draw some people into the field whose communication skills are not ideal.
Peter Ubel joining us. He's professor of medicine and psychology at the University of Michigan, where he also directs the Center for Behavioral and Decision Sciences in Medicine at the University of Michigan. Does that square with your experience, Lynn, that at least initially, your first doc at least, moved very quickly, didn't spend a lot of time trying to get a sense of what your concerns were?
Absolutely. And I'm not really sure why that was. I did ask questions. She did give me a list of websites that I could refer to. But in terms of providing a framework for making an informed decision, she basically said, this is my opinion. This is what I recommend. Take it from there. I just feel very fortunate because you are afraid, and I almost did go with a very quick commitment to surgery, but I was just fortunate that I had enough of a science background that once I got on the internet and I could read what this actually was, I realized, as Jeff said earlier, that it isn't an emergency, and you do have a little bit of time there to make an informed decision.
In some ways, it occurs to me, Dr. Belcora, that part of what's complicated about the times in which we live is not that there's too little information, but that there may be too much, that there's so much out there on the internet in particular. And what you're trying to do, it seems like in a way, is aim that a bit and to provide people with fair, balanced information that explains both sides. Give us an example of the kind of video that you might provide and what it would convey that might be different than if you go to website X, Y, or Z.
Sure. So one of the videos that we send out is a program on ductal carcinoma in situ, which is a precancerous condition. And depending on your exact situation, it has some chance of progressing into invasive cancer. Now, people can feel very differently about that prospect. They can feel differently about the likelihood, if it's a 30% chance of it progressing versus a 70% chance, and they can feel differently about the timing at which that might happen in the future, and they can also feel differently about how important that is to them, whether progressing to invasive cancer is something that, okay, I'll just deal with then, or you know whether it's something they want to deal with right away. So these videos, I think, do a terrific job at laying out, first of all, some explanation of what is ductal carcinoma in situ. It's one of these jargon-laden terms that people need to unpack. And so there are good visual images of the ducts and the cancer being confined to the ducts and what it really means for the cancer to escape into the rest of the breast. So that's one level, is just good visual presentation of information.
And does it also provide a kind of emotional source of information, Lynn, so that when you saw those videos, it wasn't just fact upon fact, statistic upon statistic, that it gave you a real person talking about a particular experience that was happening to them, happening to you?
Yes, absolutely. I think, just to step back briefly, I had the experience of trying to get the information myself because my initial program and doctor didn't provide it for me. It's a huge amount of information, and the difference between trying to sift through that all that and synthesize that as opposed to having something that is designed to do it was enormous in terms of the emotional import. Again, hugely calming, because it's very, as it's presented through this particular program, Dr. Belcora's particular program, it's very balanced. It's very reasoned. And above all, as you just suggested, you hear a voice. You hear the emotion in the voice. You see the face. You hear the doctors presenting their many different perspectives. And you hear a patient. And you see this, this can have many different outcomes. And each of these patients made an informed decision that was right for them.
Lynn is a cancer patient at UCSF, joining us this hour to talk about her experience along with Jeff Belcora, who runs the Decision Services Unit at the Breast Care Center at UCSF, and Peter Ubel, who is a professor of medicine and psychology at the University of Michigan. I'm curious about the question of how you determine risk, because as you're each suggesting, it means different things to different people. A 30% risk might mean one thing to you, different to me. And Peter Ubel, I would also suspect that it can be said in different ways by doctors, right? It can be said to sort of downplay it. It could be said to make it sound more scary, perhaps, than it is. What are you learning about the way in which risk is conveyed and how people hear that risk?
It turns out that not only can 30% feel different to me than it feels to you, 30% can feel different to me if you say it to me one way than if you say it to me another way. And so you're absolutely right. And so an example would be if I were to tell you your risk of something and then let you know that the average risk was higher or lower than that, that would completely change the way that risk felt to me.
Mm-hmm.
If I give a picture to go with that risk information, that will often help people visualize what that risk really means. There's actually a large number of people who have a very difficult time understanding things like percents. You tell someone you have a 30% chance of something happen, and there's probably a 30% chance that people don't understand what that means.
And does it also mean that if you say 30%, that feels one way versus 30 people out of 100 versus 300 out of 1,000, even though they all mean the same thing, depending on how that's conveyed, that people react differently?
Oh, 30 out of 100 is much less scary than 300 out of 1,000 to many people.
And so Dr. Belcoura, is part of what you are trying to do is give, as Lynn was suggesting earlier, a full framework. It is statistics and risks. It's also flesh and blood, the human nature of a story in a video that you see. It's getting ready to make sure you write down all your questions. It's a complete process. You can't just zone in or hone in on one particular aspect of this.
Yeah, I think it's a process of critical reflection that's very social. So as you embark on this journey, which no one ever wishes for, but sometimes it's thrust on us, you need to start making sense of what's happening. And you're going to do that through a lot of conversations and through some introspection, some conversations with yourself. And we're trying to say we want to support you at whatever appetite you have for becoming informed and involved. We want to make sure that we're giving you a structured approach. And some of the steps along the way are the things I referred to. We want to make sure that we give you some high-quality information and that we help you make a list of questions and write down that list of questions, and that we provide you with a tape recording of your visit so that you're able to not just be engaging in real time in that processing, but you're able to take it back to your family or friends or caregivers. You're able to have the conversation with yourself over time. You know, there are some conditions where this just isn't possible.
Because of time.
But increasingly, I think we're getting in the arena of medical science to the point where we're getting a lot of advance warning of conditions, and in some cases, perhaps too much advance warning of conditions. So there is often more time than people realize.
And because then there is that time, all the more important to have the right tools to process it in the right way. Lynn, I'm curious about the outcome of this for you. I mean, once you had all of these tools at your disposal, you didn't rush right into surgery. What did you wind up deciding to do?
Well, I had a type of cancer, actually. Dr. Belcoura has already described it, where it doesn't necessarily become a life-threatening cancer. So one of the options I was given is called active surveillance, where it's very closely watched. And if you choose not to have surgery until it shows signs of possible aggression, that is an option. So that was the option I took. The great thing about going through a program like Dr. Belcoura's was I was given the vocabulary so I could ask the right question to the doctor, who then could explain it to me in a way that I really understood. But I also understood that if I waited and if it showed signs of being more aggressive, the treatment would be virtually the same if they caught it before it metastasized. So that was my decision. I think the other thing that is typically not discussed is the side effects and the possible risks with the treatment itself.
Whether that's surgery or chemo or
exactly.
radiation.
So any of that can carry true long-term repercussions. also some of the dangers of surgery are not necessarily told to you. You think you're going to go in there, it's going to be nice, it's going to work.
And Peter Ubel, what do we know so far from the surveys that you're doing about there being a kind of one-to-one relationship between the more you know, choosing perhaps a less aggressive form of therapy? Is that something that we're finding out, that if you know more, you may be less likely to go right into surgery?
It really would depend on the specific clinical situation. I think that in prostate cancer, breast cancer, you may see that, but not necessarily. In more advanced forms of breast cancer, there's actually been some evidence that women who are more involved in their decision are more likely to get the full mastectomy surgery rather than the lumpectomy. So they actually opt for more aggressive. So and the outcome here shouldn't be, are you saving money by getting patients informed? Are you having them do less? The question is, are they finding out what fits their own values best?
And on that point, Lynn also talked about not necessarily initially getting a lot of information about the consequence of treatment in terms of side effects, be that for surgery or any number of things. Does that also ring true to you in your research, that the doctors tend to talk more about the benefits than they do about the risks and consequences?
That's what patients remember. They remember hearing about the benefits more than hearing about the risks. When I've seen the conversations we've studied, I think what happens is they start off by saying the benefits, then they kind of, like the drug ads do on TV, they start listing a whole bunch of risks real fast, then they come back to the benefits to wrap the present in a nice bow, and I think people end up remembering the upside and not as much of the downside.
And is that important, Dr. Belcour in particular, to why it matters in your program to be prepared to write down that list of questions, and when you go to the doctor's office, to actually record it, which is an interesting part of what you do as well, so that in that rush of information and maybe in that quick, oh, by the way, there may be this consequences that happens at the end, that you've got that down.
Yeah, exactly right, that if you're trying to absorb a lot of information, your oncologist or your surgeon is someone who really wants to help you and wants to convey their expertise. And just the way things are structured, you might get half an hour or 45 minutes or an hour with them in discussing a major medical condition like this. And so they're going to try to give you as much information as they can. And if you can time shift and place shift the review of that information, that's what we see our patients appreciating, is that we have people drive here from far away to see one of our oncologists and then listen to the CD that we give them in the car on the way home, you know, with their spouse, and say, wow, there were things that I had totally missed. And
so you give that's instant feedback. I mean, they walk away from that doctor's appointment with a CD that has the recording of the appointment itself.
Yeah, in most cases, we're able to give patients a CD audio recording and a written summary as well, because we also want to give people sort of the gist of what happened. So the recording provides the detail. If you want to go back and listen to, you know, I completely spaced out on the side effect discussion. You know, let's go back over that. You can do that in detail. But if you also want a one- or two-page plain English summary, that's what's prepared for our many of our patients by our pre-medical interns.
Dr. Jeff Belcour joining us this hour. He directs the Decisions Services Unit at the University of California, San Francisco's Breast Care Center. He joins us this hour along with Peter Ubel, who is a professor of medicine and psychology at the University of Michigan and director of their Center for Behavioral and Decision Sciences, and Lynn, who's a cancer patient who has gone through this process of coming to terms with the diagnosis and figuring out what to do next. When we return, we'll open up our phone lines. We'd like to hear from you. What have been your experiences in this arena? What sort of services would you find helpful in coming to terms with your own situation? Here's the number, 866-733-6786. 866-733-6786. Welcome back to Forum. I'm Dave Iverson. Our topic this hour, how patients can become more engaged in their course of treatment if they're facing a difficult condition. What kinds of things do patients need to know if they're going to make thoughtful decisions about the kind of treatment that actually affects them? We're joined by Jeff Belcour, who runs the Decision Services Unit at the Breast Care Center at UCSF, Lynn, who's been a patient there at that particular center, and Peter Ubel, who also studies these issues. He's a professor of medicine and psychology at the University of Michigan. We welcome your thoughts and calls on this, too. You can join us now at 866-733-6786. 866-733-6786, or email us at forum at kqed.org. We'll get to your calls in just a moment, but I want to follow up on one part of this process that we haven't described yet at UCSF, and that's, Lynn, having a pre-medical student, someone who's finished college but is on their way to medical school, was available to help you in this process as you got ready. What did they actually do for you?
Well, initially you have a phone call pre-consult. So before you go to see your doctor, you have a pre-consult with the pre-medical intern. It made a huge difference in that I had already had my own questions written down. But when I had to work it out with someone else on the phone, it was like a rehearsal. I realized this question is not really asking what I wanted to ask. And in the process of building your list of questions with the intern, you come up with something that is far more focused. I would believe that the doctor would be happy about that, because you can ask your question, you've already rehearsed it, you already know the terminology, and you already know that this question is really what you want to know.
I want to get to the interesting question of how doctors respond to all this in just a moment, but Dr. Belcora, fill in, if you will, why it's useful to have someone with that particular background. I mean, it makes sense that you don't want to go this alone, but I'm sure many people come in with their spouses or partners or sons or daughters. But is there something additionally useful or different about having someone with this particular background be of assistance to?
Well, you know, we train the pre-medical interns to be neutral facilitators. So, I mean, that's one of the things, is that they're not emotionally hooked and they don't have the training to give advice or information. So really, they're incredibly patient-focused and patient-centered. And their job is to help you express the questions you have. And they do that through active listening and through question prompting. And another benefit is they type up the list of questions. It's legible and clear. And then they get it to the doctor in advance.
Oh.
So, you know, the doctor has an opportunity to review that and then use that as part of the agenda for their meeting.
And let's talk for a moment, and then we'll go to your calls, about how doctors view all this. Peter Ubel, thoughts on that? Because in a way, this is all obviously aimed at something that one would think would be an outcome everyone would want, having a patient be informed, be able to be precise about what it is he or she wants. But do doctors find this threatening? Do doctors find this challenging to have to contend with all of this extra input?
It definitely will vary from one doctor to another, and it's a good measure of whether the doctor is a good fit for you as a patient. Hmm. If you feel like the doctor's rolling his or her eyes at the questions you ask, that's a bad sign that that's not a good fit in the relationship. I happen to love this kind of thing. If a patient comes in with lots of questions, I know what's on their mind. I can help them better. If I don't know what someone's thinking or feeling, I'm not as able to help them.
And yet at the same time, I wonder if there is a certain desire among patients, no matter how informed, that we kind of want you to be an authority figure, right, Dr. Ubel? I mean, if you're feeling like there's so many treatment options and there's so many possibilities, isn't it also part of the appropriate role of the doctor to say, here's what I think you should do?
Oh, absolutely. And the key, though, is, can I understand enough about that patient in front of me that I can make that kind of recommendation and know it fits them better?
Yeah, yeah.
And so that's where you want a doctor who at least understands where you're coming from.
And to our calls, let's go first to Karen in San Mateo. Karen, go ahead, please.
Hi, yes, I just had a comment. I would just like to say that I do believe that my doctor's ego may have been involved in what turned out to be a self-diagnosis for me. And as it turns out, I had Hashimoto's disease for probably over a decade. I had such a strange laundry list of symptoms, it almost read like the bad side effects off of a drug. I told my doctor I was lethargic. I'd had a hoarse voice for year after year, and I finally ended up looking for a board-certified endocrinologist on my own, and in one visit, I was pretty much diagnosed with Hashimoto's disease after months and months of almost being incapacitated by lethargy and an inability to concentrate at my job. I don't feel as though, and I didn't disagree with my doctor on everything that she'd ever spoken to me about, but in this regard, I lost a lot of faith and trust in her and respect.
Karen, thanks. Thanks for the call and observation. And in some ways, it speaks, too, to what Peter Ubel was saying, Jeff Belcora, about one of the things you should be paying attention to is how your doctor responds to you. If they're not someone who's very welcoming of raising lots of questions or voicing lots of concerns, that's a kind of red flag.
Yeah, I think the three values that I'm promoting with our pre-medical interns who are going to grow up to be the next generation of doctors is they are fallibility, perspective taking, and curiosity. And so I think, you know, those are things that if a doctor can't admit that they're fallible, then, you know, they're just not admitting they're human. And if they're not curious about your input and what your perspectives are on what might be going on, if they're not looking outside their own specialty and outside their own kind of comfort zone, and then, you know, if they're not able to sort of take different perspectives and see things from your point of view as well as from the medical specialist point of view, that is a red flag.
And to Michael in San Anselmo. Michael, go ahead.
Hi, I'm a colleague of Dr. Belcour's at UCSF, and I used to work with him at the Breast Care Center. And while I was there, I contracted prostate cancer, and I was able to take advantage of his services to help me arrive at a treatment decision, which I found to be very helpful and very specific to what I cared about. So I want to put in a plug for his services.
Okay, Michael, thank you. And we should talk about the availability of these services. Lynn mentioned initially that she was not able to access these early on and wound up being able to get to UC and get these. But how prevalent, how common are these? Yours is supported by a particular foundation grant. Is it rare? Is it unusual? Is this happening more?
Well, let me express that there's an increasing interest in this area. It's still in the stage of being very innovative to provide this kind of support. But I want to point to a number of resources that your listeners could look to. In addition to our work at UCSF, I work with the Palo Alto Medical Foundation that has terrific resources. They're part of Sutter Health. They have a resource center, and they're very supportive of patients. I'm myself a member of Kaiser Permanente. My family gets care there, and they contract with HealthWise, which is an organization in Idaho that provides patient education materials that are very high quality. I guess netting it out, you should network as a patient. You should network with resource centers and health libraries, and you should look to different places than you might otherwise look for health information. For example, your health plan has a real interest in you becoming informed and involved because it results in happier patients and patients usually with better outcomes, and yes, in some cases with less resource use. So I guess part of my message is it's not just what we're doing at UCSF. There's really other resources out there. I want to plug Breast Cancer Connections in the Palo Alto area. The Wellness Community is a national chain of resource centers just merged with Gildas Club, and they have online resources as well as physical sites in the Bay Area.
And for people listening who want to sort of find their way through that laundry list of possibilities, is there a place you can go that can sort of direct you to other places or to a central source for help in decision making?
Yeah, there's, you know, for one thing, I think maybe we can get on the website for this show. I can provide the links to a number of these organizations. And on my website, guidesmith.org, I have some resources. That's just a kind of a blog that I have on this topic. And generally speaking, you know, certainly for a cancer diagnosis, the wellness community is a good one-stop shop. American Cancer Society, National Cancer Institute have resources as well.
Here's an email that raises an interesting point. Peter Ubel, maybe you can respond to it. Susan writes, "When diagnosed with breast cancer, I took time to research my options and in retrospect, I'm content with my treatment choice. However, my mother's experience 2 years later was completely different. Information frightened her more than her doctor's authoritative presence. We need to be sure we don't force patients outside of their comfort zone." So here again, it's this question of every patient being different. And to some extent, there may be patients, Peter Ubel, who want an authoritative figure. And would you, are you comfortable with that approach too?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, a lot of the moral weight behind this whole idea of involving patients in their decisions is that they have rights as patients to have a voice. But if their voice is to say, "I don't want to make this decision," we shouldn't ignore that. Now, on the other hand, I don't just take that and say, "Okay, then great, I'll tell you what to do."
Yeah.
That's a point at which I say, "Well, let me understand you better then before I can give you a recommendation. And by the way, if that recommendation doesn't feel right to you, we'll talk about some other options. I'm still your doctor, and I'll be happy with whatever you decide."
And to David next in Oakland. David, go ahead.
Yeah, hi. I'm actually a physician, and my fiancé is a breast cancer survivor. So I guess my question is related, and I appreciate your comments about, you know, how patients struggle with this. What about the influences that doctors feel in terms of the pharmaceutical companies and the pressure that one gets, you know, to sort of do something? And how do we really come to the best answers in terms of for our patients and ultimately for our society?
David, thank you. Jeff Belcora?
Yeah, I'd like to address that because I think you're articulating exactly how doctors and patients are caught in between major forces in our healthcare economy. There's, you know, a massive force around pushing revenue for pharmaceutical companies and device manufacturers. And then there's a massive force around cutting costs. And sometimes that shows up in insurance and other plans. So part of being informed and involved, one of the reasons to be informed and involved, is because you don't want to be overtreated with, you know, to make somebody's business more profitable. On the other hand, you don't want to be undertreated. And so finding that balance of the right treatment for you, and I go back to what I said about you have totally unique feelings about the timing and the likelihood and the value of the different outcomes that you may face.
Does that also mean that patients should, for example, investigate whether or not their doctor has a particular relationship with a pharmaceutical company or is engaged in research on a particular drug, just so that not necessarily to be paranoid about that, but to know sort of what their particular orientation is?
Yeah, I think that, you know, we don't want to get to the point where we're not allowing some of this natural cross-fertilization and communication and collaboration to occur between, say, the pharmaceutical industry or, if you're on the health services side, the insurance industry. But at the same time, I think transparency is the name of the game here. You want to understand where people are coming from and what might be influencing that.
It also occurs to me, Lynn, that in this process of putting more responsibility in a way on the patient to make decisions about his or her care, that you're taking on more, and you're taking on more in an ongoing way. I mean, one of the, in a sense, disadvantages, if that's the right way to put it, of the choice you made is that you've got to keep paying attention. I mean, this is something that you're now in for the long haul.
That's really true. And I think this is part of, I would say, the long-term change that happens when you get a diagnosis like this. But you have to realize that once you have cancer, no matter what your choice is, you have it. You're going to be different. You've been confronted with death and the big life questions in a very immediate way. So it's not like if you have surgery, then it's done. If you have surgery, especially a mastectomy, you live with that. It just changes your life. And however it's right for you to resolve that or interpret that, that's what you should do. If it's easier for you to have surgery and then try and forget it, but it's not like it never happened.
And back to our calls. Let's hear next from Christian, who joins us this morning from Napa. Christian, go ahead, please.
Hi. I suffer from trigeminal neuralgia, or TN, and during the course of my treatment, I was originally diagnosed by my general practitioner, but in the process of finding treatment, I went through 6 neurologists and 3 neurosurgeons. I've had 2 brain surgeries in the last 6 years to have a very kind of mediocre outcome. But the real question or the issue I had was, as I went through this process, was finding the neurologists or the physicians that had a fluency in this, you know, fairly small niche of a diagnosis. I was just really disappointed with the amount of effort that a lot of the neurologists put into understanding the condition.
Christian, thanks. Peter Ubel, reactions to Christian's and that general problem that if you have something that perhaps is less common, how much work you have to do to find someone who can provide you with the information you need?
It's a really tough problem because how are you to know whether that doctor you're seeing knows enough about that condition? And if to come, and it's hard for most people to work up the guts to say, how many patients have you taken care of this year with my problem?
Yeah.
Who else around here has more experience? Because they feel like you're challenging them. That's a very hard thing for people to do.
It's a point in life where tentativeness is not helpful in a way, right? I mean, this is a time where being assertive, Peter Ubel, is you have to call upon yourself to sort of be tougher in a way, more confrontive almost in a way than you might normally be.
Politely assertive, maybe.
Yeah.
You know, and just friendly, just say to them, you know, I've enjoyed my interactions with you, but I know this is I've heard this is a rare disease. If you were me, would you be looking for someone with more experience in it?
Yeah, Yeah. Aprajita joins us next from Chapel Hill, North Carolina. Go ahead, please.
Hi. I actually had the privilege of working with Dr. Belcora for a year as a pre-medical intern who sat with women. And I spoke to about over 50 women during that year. And I just wanted to say that it's sort of extremely helpful, not only for the women, but also for someone like me and my colleagues as pre-medical interns about to enter the field of medicine to sort of be aware that decision-making at this level has to be a shared process, and that each individual has different things going on in his or her life. And also, we were sort of at the other end of the power dynamic in terms of, you know, being very much on the path of the patient. And I think that's great experience and sort of helps to create, I think, a very slow but effective cultural shift towards realizing that shared decision-making is sort of the way to go.
Aprajita, thanks. Thanks for joining in our conversation today and adding your perspective as someone who's worked through this program. A couple of other emails coming in. Lynn in Woodside writes, listening to Dr. Belcora, I'm grateful that decision-making in the face of cancer has made strides. 20 years ago, I had a lumpectomy at UCSF. This was in the days when this was just being investigated and the internet was not available. I was overwhelmed by the variety of opinions getting a diagnosis that I could decide on treating for mastectomy, lumpectomy, radiation, tamoxifen trials. I realize often to the chagrin of various patronizing professionals and fearful family members that I had to navigate a solution based on my own sensibilities. It was a difficult time. And Shelley writes, I'm curious about the fact that Lynn finds it's necessary to protect her identity to avoid workplace discrimination. How big a problem is that still for cancer patients? Lynn, you want to comment on that about the feeling that this is still something in our society, just as we're talking about other cultural shifts and doctors changing, that when you have that diagnosis, that's still something that you have to contend with in the rest of your professional life?
You know, I actually was surprised that as I went through this process and I was diagnosed 2 years ago, that I did start to feel like I had to be careful about who I took into confidence about this. I don't think it's just cancer. I just think it's any health issue. I have at times been involved in hiring, and I know that it just influences the way an employer will think about you. Their concern, I think, is totally practical. Will she need to leave for 5 weeks to have surgery or go on medication? I don't think that it is as cruel as it may sound from my desire to remain somewhat anonymous. I do think people can be compassionate. I just think in the workplace, you don't want to have to contend with that. And you don't want to ask your supervisors to contend with it either. You just want to be able to do your work and sort of leave that on the outside.
And is this yet another aspect of how we contend with these issues, Jeff Belcora, that should be factored into how doctors are trained, that there should be sensitivity to that sort of consequence to a diagnosis? It's not just what treatment you choose to have, but the way in which this may play out in that person's life more generally.
Right. And I think that some of that rehearsal that Lynn described is giving patients an opportunity to really voice to their doctors in a fairly succinct way, you know, what's going on in their life and what's important to them. Look, for some people, privacy is really important. For others, it's not quite as big an issue. For some people, hair loss is a really big deal and breast cancer. For others, it's not as big a deal. You could go on and on about all the things that we just have different feelings about. And so, yeah, I think you know, for our doctors, and I think the medical profession is really moving in this direction, and we'll get there, that you know, they're starting to see the whole person, not just the patient and the disease. And that's the goal.
And to Tanya, next in Santa Rosa. Tanya, go ahead.
Yes. I have an autoimmune disease, and I was recommended a certain type of treatment, which I refuse. And I was told by my doctor that it would put in my chart that I would be I was refusing treatment. And I was wondering, by refusing treatment, would this affect, with health insurance, my coverage or my ability to see another doctor?
See if we can get a response to that. Peter Ubel, any thoughts on that problem? What happens if a doctor says, I'm going to write down that you're refusing treatment?
Oh, boy. So I'm reminded of that Seinfeld episode where Elaine is described in the chart as a difficult patient. I don't know why your doctor, I mean, your doctor would need to perhaps say what was discussed with you and what you chose to do, but if it's done in a way, it's written to say this is a difficult patient, that's just inappropriate. You know, you have, it's your body, and you have the right to make a decision.
Jeff Belcourt or Lynn, any sense of if part of this process sometimes means that patients say, you know what, I'm not going to do anything right now. Does that have consequences that they ought to be aware of in terms of insurance or the doctor they see?
That's a great question. You know, I think one of the solutions that we're heading towards is total transparency in the charting and note-taking. And that's one of the reasons we create a patient-friendly summary that we give to patients as well as the recording is so that there really is a trail. On the other hand, you're raising the question of, so who else is going to use that information? And I'm somewhat optimistic that the privacy laws and the professional standards prevent abuse of that kind of information. But I have to say I'm not an expert on it. And maybe one of our callers or listeners could comment further.
Jessica in San Francisco. Go ahead. You're on.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. I just appreciate the fact that this is going on. And basically, when my mother was diagnosed with a very rare and terminal sarcoma, she was so paralyzed by the news, she sort of numbed out, as one of the other callers mentioned, happened to a relative of hers. And I kept thinking if there had been some sort of relative guidebook, you know, as if, you know, what to do when you have cancer. So you've been diagnosed with cancer, you know, not to be lighthearted, but we as a family ended up becoming so proactive to help with her care and find out as much research as we could because she just wasn't able to do it. And then it dawned on me, what do people do that don't have families? So I think this program, you know, being instilled is great for everyone, and I'm hoping that it will be the trend in the cancer field.
Jessica, thanks. Interesting question about not only educating the patient, but everyone else in that patient's universe.
Yeah, and there's a great book by Jesse Grumman called Aftershock that I would recommend for, you know, family members and patients who are dealing with a diagnosis like this.
And I would like to say the question of family is a very important consideration. I didn't happen to have family here in San Francisco. And my family, while loving, just couldn't really provide the support. And that's where a program like Dr. Belcourt's, again, made a huge difference. And secondly, I think even if they want to support you, a lot of times if they go with you to your doctor's appointment, they're as shocked as you are. And to have someone who understands the language, in this case, the pre-med interns, is almost indescribably helpful in a way that until you're emotionally there, it's very difficult to understand what it takes, not only for you, but for your family members.
And Peter Ubel, I'm curious about the future of this. Foundations are supporting this effort, like here at UCSF. It would seem in the end like it's in everyone's best interest, not only patients, but providers too. And that while the goal may not be to provide less aggressive care, if it has the consequence of lowering costs, at least appropriately in some places, that would be of benefit too. Can this be supported? Can this become the norm?
I hope so. And I think the U.S. will probably lead the way. We're a much more consumeristic society. People feel they have a right to be involved in these decisions. And I think money is going to play a bigger role in the decisions we make. More things are going to come out of our patients' pockets. And so I actually would say to all listeners out there, if you're struggling with your medical costs, talk to your doctor. There might be a cheaper pill that's just as good your doctor didn't know you were struggling with the money. And that may end up being triggering the kind of conversations we should have been having when money wasn't an issue.
I'm curious about you saying that the U.S. may be a bit ahead on this. We tend to not think of ourselves as being ahead of many other industrialized nations. Is that just because there is more of a sort of individualistic, consumer-oriented focus in this country?
Oh, yes. If you go over to, say, Asia, the doctor knows best.
Yeah. Just a moment or two remaining. So I'm curious about getting your last thoughts on how this will go from here, the kinds of things that patients who are struggling with these conditions really ought to think about. If you want to think through sort of your checklist at this particular moment in time, you're someone, Jeff Belcourt, who's just gotten a diagnosis of a serious condition. Start us out on what you think ought to be top of mind?
Yeah, well, the first thing is just to orient yourself towards this as a project. You know, I talk to counsel. We counsel many people, hundreds of people a year, and we're always looking to connect them with the other projects that they've had in their lives. No one wants this project, this cancer project, for example. It's not something you signed up for. But in your professional life, you've probably dealt with very complex projects. At home, whether it's been a remodel or planning a wedding or you know, sewing a quilt, you've done projects and you've kind of managed them. Now, this is happening at a time when you're not feeling like you're going to be a good project manager because you're under all this shock. But if you can orient yourself towards this is likely not an emergency and you actually do need to be your own project manager, that's the first important step to take.
And often part of being a good project manager is having people that you can assemble, right, as being part of your team.
Exactly.
It's like subcontractors.
Yeah.
And you need other people along with you.
That's right. And the help that shows up on your doorstep may not be the help you need. So you need to be managing people's roles and responsibilities. If you have a relative who, frankly, means well but doesn't do good things for you, you need to manage them out and you need to find a friend who's maybe neutral or a friend of a friend who can help come to your appointments with you, that kind of thing.
And Lynn, a last word from you about what you've learned really along the way and what you'd recommend others who may, like it or not, face these kinds of choices in the future.
Well, I think without a doubt it is a hugely emotional experience. And of course, that's going to vary from person to person. But I found that the emotional part turned out to be one of the more difficult things to resolve. So I would say recognize that you have an emotional life and then turn to people or programs like this that will give you the benefit of reason, support that is not only from family, but from people who know the field and can help you navigate it.
Lynn, thanks for being part of our program today. We were joined also by Jeff Belcora, who directs the Decision Services Unit at the University of California, San Francisco's Breast Care Center. Jeff Belcora, thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
And Peter Ubel joined us as well, professor of medicine and psychology at the University of Michigan. Dr. Ubel, thank you.
My pleasure.
Forum is produced by Kevin Guillory, Tina Lauerberg, Judy Campbell, and Erica Kelly. Our senior editor is Dan Zoll. Our engineer this hour, Paul Lancour. Executive producer, Raul Ramirez. I'm Dave Iverson, and this is Forum.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Claude and Louise Rosenberg Jr. Family Foundation.